when you do sometimes stuff looking for the future of your kids, for looking for a good future, you don't measure the consequences. You just try to give them the opportunity, and then you will deal with the consequences.
That's a local mother, Carmen, who came to the United States from Ecuador during a crippling economic recession. She's overstayed a work visa, so she's here illegally, but she has one child who is a citizen of this country. So if Carmen gets detained or deported, the question becomes, who takes care of that young boy? Families with mixed immigration status throughout the metro are facing a similar predicament, and oftentimes, they don't know anyone with legal status who they'd trust to take care of their kids. But at James Elementary, in the historic Northeast, there's a bilingual administrative assistant who's been made power of attorney for 4 different families at the school.
I always tell them, I don't want you to know that it's not going to be permanent. I will make sure you're safe, and I will get you to your parents when it's convenient.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're going to get to know the school secretary who has stepped into these family lives in such a crucial way. Nayeli Murillo, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thank you.
So what is your role, first of all, at the school?
I'm the secretary of the school. I'm in the main office. So I kind of do it all. I take care of the attendance, and I'm also the interpreter for the school. 80% of our families don't speak English.
And so the interpretation part has sort of informally created a different kind of relationship with a lot of the families. You've stepped in so many different arenas.
Definitely. Since they don't have anybody else to go to, they feel like if they come to the office, I'm right there to answer any kind of questions, not just school related, but any questions that they might have.
For example?
For example, when the immigration topic was very, very hot and they didn't know what to do, they wanted some information, they wanted advice on what to do, I was right there for them to answer any questions.
What was your background? I mean, did you feel prepared to answer these questions, or did you have to go hunting yourself?
I've been through the process myself. I came to the United States when I was 11 as an illegal immigrant. So I've been through the process. I have most of the questions, but I've also been educated through the Mexican consulate. I work for the Kansas City Public School District, and we work together with the Mexican consulate to kind of help our families through the process of to become legal.
When you say that you've been through the process yourself, can you tell me a little bit more of that story? I mean, how long ago? You were 11, so this was a while ago, but yeah, what were the circumstances and how did you find your way through that process?
Like I said, I came here when I was 11 years old. I came as a minor illegally. My parents brought me here.
From where?
From Mexico. And then I've been in the U.S. for 19 years, but 5 years ago, I got married to a U.S. citizen who helped me get legal status. I then had to go to Mexico to apply for a waiver since I came in the U.S. illegally. I was in Mexico for about a year and a half. My waiver was denied twice, because I couldn't prove that I had to be here in the U.S.
So explain how the waiver fits into it.
If you come into the United States illegally, you must apply for a waiver. And you have to get out of the country. The law keeps changing. So at the time, you had to leave the country to go to the U.S. Embassy in Mexico and apply for that waiver. You have to provide a series of paperwork to prove that you need to be in the United States. I didn't have enough paperwork the first and the second time, so I had to stay for about a year and a half before I could get approved to come back to the United States.
What was that year and a half like? Was your husband there with you?
He was not. It was just my son and I, and my son was 4 at the time. When we went to Mexico, my son did not speak any Spanish whatsoever, so it was very hard for him. I could speak Spanish, but I had not been there for a while, so I was only there as a child. So going back, it was hard for me, especially because we are from a very rural community, nothing like the U.S. So that was very hard for me. No transportation. Had to find a job that, you know, the pay per day, it's like what you get here for an hour.
When you took a job at an elementary school working as an administrative assistant, did you think that you were going to be helping other families in situations like yours?
I did not know I was going to be helping. I knew the population was mostly Hispanic. So I knew that I would be interpreting, but I didn't know I was going to be helping them through the legal process, or at least I can't help them directly, but I can guide them in the right direction.
So when you are working, I hear that you are also sort of informally on some level the counselor for a lot of these students.
Yes, we do not have a counselor this year at James Elementary. Therefore, most of our Spanish-speaking students who are dealing with any problems or our parents, they come to me. So I kind of help them out, you know, providing them the resources that they need so that they can get help.
That feels like just a lot on your job description. Is that part of your job description, or you just do it because you're a human being who sees people who need something that, and you're the only one there to do it?
It is not part of my job description, but since I've been through there and I know how hard it is to be there when nobody speaks your language, when I came to the U.S., I came to a school that my brother and I were the only ones that spoke Spanish in the whole entire school. No staff members, no students that could speak Spanish. I feel for them being in the situation, so I just humanly do it.
Do you remember the first time you were approached by a family about being power of attorney in the event that the parents would get detained or deported?
I do. I remember we were at a Cinco de Mayo celebration at the school. I know the family because she volunteers at the school quite often, and she told me she was afraid of the whole situation, and she said, I don't know who to go to or who to ask. The conversation ended right then, but then we were at a celebration at the school. After the celebration, she came up to me and she goes, I've been trying to think of somebody that would be able to help me do power of attorney for my kids. And I have nobody that has legal status that could help me. She goes, you are the only one that I can trust to take care of my kids. Would you be willing to help?
What did you do? Did you say yes on the spot, or did you have to kind of think about that? It's a big responsibility.
I said yes right away.
What does that mean as you, I mean, you're now power of attorney for four different families. What does that mean for you as you think about your own future?
The reason I said yes on the spot is because I can just feel and see the frustration on her face, not knowing what to do. And I felt very honored to be trusted that way with her kids. I mean, your kids are something that's very important, and you just don't leave them with anybody. I feel very, very trusted, and it made me feel really good. So that's why I said yes. Then kind of from there, she told another family that I was the power of attorney. They came and asked me, and then now I have power of attorney for four families. I do know that it may be kind of hard in the future if this situation were to happen at the same time, which I don't think so. But if in case that happens...
Yeah, like a worst case scenario from the vantage point of like practical considerations at the very least.
Yeah, it would be very hard if it were to happen at the same time for four families, especially because they have two kids. Yeah, two kids each family. So that would be eight children. In addition to my three that I have. So that would be a lot of people in my house. But like I said, I told them that I wouldn't keep them forever. I would just take them to, and I have information for families in Mexico of these families that I know I can call and take these kids to.
So you would be in a position to figure out the next step is how you see it.
Correct. I would just have to figure out, who to take the students to, or maybe keep them for a couple of days and then figure out what I needed to do, depending on the parent situation.
That also puts you in such an intimate role in these families' lives, not just if it would come to pass that they get that someone gets detained or deported, but just recognizing that possibility. Do you feel like your relationships with all of these families and the students at your school has changed?
Definitely. I feel part of the family, and they consider me part of their family. I now get invited to family events, and I didn't before. I feel more of a connection with these families.
Do you feel like you have the information about all of these families to be able to make what would be, to even know what would be best for the kids in the event that their parents are deported, whether it would be to reunite them with someone elsewhere or to help them find a solution here in the States?
I've sat down with all of the families and we've had a conversation of what their wishes are for me to do. And in case they were not available to make decisions, if I would have to try to find out if reuniting them with a family member in Mexico or figuring out here their situation would be best. We've sat down and talked about it before.
So you're really like embodying the will of their parents in some ways if this happens.
Yes.
What, you know, you have talked with them about probably like bank accounts and all sorts of really personal information. How do you navigate that kind of terrain?
It's hard. It was hard because I've came into their home and they've kind of showed me, okay, so this is where I have all of the important papers. And like I said, I feel really honored that they trust me that way. They've brought me into their homes. They've showed me where their important information is. And it just makes me feel very, very honored to be part of this process with them.
You are doing all of this very informally in terms of just like what is actually your role at the elementary school where you work. And I wonder what you think in a perfect world, what kind of services would be formally provided to families and students who are bilingual and possibly dealing with immigration issues?
I believe that almost everywhere you go now, you have the option to have an interpreter over the phone. Over the phone doesn't always help. I feel like having somebody on site, especially for the majority of the, you know, the second language in the U.S. is Spanish. Having somebody on site that can help you right away, it's going to be more helpful than somebody on the phone. You can't express your emotions to somebody on the phone, but you can do that with someone that's right there with you.
Are there situations that you think people do need maybe special training to be interpreters for? Like, should schools have interpreters?
I think so. I think they should have at least, you know, whatever the language they have the most at the school, I believe they should have somebody on site.
Can you tell me just the story of maybe one of the kids who could end up in your care for some period of time if their parents get deported?
Yeah. One of the families that really touches me, those kids have a passion for soccer. They love playing soccer. And they're always asking me, Miss Nayeli, if my parents ever get detained, will I still be able to play soccer? Because to them, as a 7-year-old, that's their life, playing soccer. And I always tell them, I will keep taking you to your games. I'm going to take you to practices. And then once mom and dad are back in Mexico, we can help you reunite them.
Nayeli Murillo, thanks so much for joining us from James Elementary.
Thank you.
When we return on KCUR Central Standard, a local hip-hop artist with a new EP. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. This song was recorded in a hotel room at a gaming convention.
Dash. Gamer concerts at the harbor. Hair is nappy, I need a barber. Hotel room, I'm recording between the parties. Chefs and Bill are prepping for the stage and we're gonna slaughter. I could use some room service.
Good morning. Welcome to the show. This is the first song on an album called Room Service by Kadesh Flow.
Hey, how's it going?
So tell me about this conference where you recorded an EP in a hotel room.
Yeah, it's called MAGFest. It stands for Music and Gaming Festival. It's the only event that I know of that's simultaneously a music festival and a gaming convention. And I've played at it for the last 3 years, both main stage and some of the smaller performances.
And so you're a musician and a gamer, and I want to start with the music, and then we'll get to the gaming piece of it, okay?
Sure.
I understand you recently left a job at Cerner to pursue music. Tell me about that decision.
So it was actually, I left C2FO, and I was at Cerner before. But basically, when I left Cerner and went to C2FO, it's, you know, Sandy Kipper runs the company. It's very on the up and up, making a lot of global news. You work very hard while you're there, but they have a very flexible vacation policy. That allowed me to build a lot of momentum because I could tour when I needed to tour. I could take a week off to play South by Southwest and network. And just building that kind of created this situation where I was working a lot between music and my job. And I just had to make a decision from a bandwidth standpoint.
And so was that scary to you? I mean, you're part of a local band, The Fantastics.
Yes.
And you've been touring as an independent hip-hop artist as well. That's still a pretty big jump.
Yeah. Yeah, it's huge. It's terrifying. And I think it's something that a lot of artists need to understand. My goal is to be able to manage my schedule more so than necessarily just only be making money off of music. I have a bunch of side hustles, but I need to be able to control that schedule so that I could get in those recording sessions and travel when I need to travel and what have you.
And then, I mean, I guess getting in the recording sessions helps when you have them at a hotel room at a convention.
Yeah, that was really beautiful too. Just a lot of people who I don't see a lot from all different parts of the country, and we're just vibing in a hotel room between shows. People coming in, you know, it's like 3 a.m. and we just left a party that was the after party for a show, and then we're making beats and, you know, drinking a little and just kind of communicating about what we should change and all these other things. It was really gorgeous. The whole moment was amazing.
So tell me more about the gaming community that you're part of.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different facets of music and gaming that intertwine. So I think I got involved in this community, generally the nerdcore community, via Mega Ran, he calls himself a chip hop artist, but he's probably the premier indie hip hop voice in the nerdy scene.
Okay, so nerdcore, nerdy scene. Mm-hmm. What exactly are you talking about?
Music that talks about things that typically are attributed to nerds. Now all of it's more pop culture, which is very interesting.
So, but like nerds, you don't mean that generically.
No. I mean, things related to tech, things related to sci-fi, video games, anime, things that, like I said, at one point were attributed exclusively to nerds, fantasy, but now really is across the board, and it should have been that way the whole time. So it's kind of a genre that has a subgenre of music that's taken ownership of something that was used as an insult, and that scene's really growing.
And you're a part of something called the Nerdy People of Color Collective?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
So that was something that Mega Ran founded. He found a bunch of us on the internet, and a lot of us were inspired by him because really there wasn't a person of color who sounded like hip-hop because he's a Philly cat. Sounds like, you know, Biggie rapping about video games to an extent. And pulled us all together. It includes Samus, who's gotten a lot of footage, a lot of coverage, Richie Branson, who's made a lot of noise, and a bunch of people, Xavier Woods in the WWE. We all just link up and started collaborating and doing shows together, and now it's like a family. So we just show up at conventions, at events. We're on each other's albums, and we try to make sure that there's just an open space and network for marginalized people who are in these spaces, because historically, they've been pretty white and male, and in a sense, gatekept, even though it's supposed to be a safe space for people who are rejected.
So, in what sense, gatekept?
Certain things aren't considered nerdy enough. Certain things are considered too black, too
like,
Asian.
Like what?
Rap in general. Like rap that isn't ironic is a great example. Rap that isn't kind of faux rap. So it's kind of been breaking in because there are people who are, you know, pretty hood who are really into video games, for example, and did not feel like they could be included in these spaces. And what's interesting now is you have people coming through at conventions and openly rapping with video game and anime punchlines, and they're inspired by us the same way that we were inspired by Mega Ran. It's really awesome.
The idea of not being nerdy enough is really funny.
It's hilarious. It's completely absurd.
I want to get back to your new EP, Room Service. Let's play a little bit of a couple of different songs. We'll start with Glassy Eyes, which sounds, at first anyway, to me, like a video game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's listen.
Living this life is amazing, bopping, we feeling so wavy. Living this life is amazing, bopping, we feeling so wavy. Living this life is amazing, bopping, we feeling so wavy. I am not here to be average, every beat I touch is rapid. Look, my ambition is massive, I am not here to be passive. I am not here for you.
Kadesh Flow, what are we hearing?
The whole concept of this song, I actually wanted to start it out in a way that sounded a little bit like an 8-bit intro or 16-bit intro, to your point about it sounding like a video game. But this song is about being in awe of the fact that we're in this place playing these huge festivals, these huge conventions around the country, and we're excited that we kind of broke through this glass ceiling that I was just talking about. And it would take some going in the depth to, because there's a lot of nuance there, but it's nice to be in that position. But it's also talking a little bit about how it's ridiculous that there was even a ceiling that needed to be broken through. So it's kind of a excitement celebration, but admonishing and talking about an issue at the same time sort of song.
How did you get into tech?
Me, really, I've always kind of been into it. I had to step away from trying to become a programmer to focus on my development as an artist when I was in college. So I just left it, and I'm still trying to get back, or saying I'm going to get back into it. But then I ended up working on my MBA and focusing on analytics and marketing, market research, and moving in the Cerner on the healthcare IT side and being somewhat of a sales and consultant support sort of person. So it's always kind of been linked, like all the worlds that I've really been interested in, music, tech, gaming, anime, it's all kind of been linked by a pretty thin thread. It's really fascinating that I've kind of been able to bring it together musically, in a sense.
Did the impression that it was a very white kind of space, did that intimidate you in any way or create some kind of stumbling block as you were developing your early interests?
No. So as problematic as some situations tend to be, I tend to view them from a lens of humor for the most part. I don't know if that's a defense mechanism because otherwise they'd be infuriating. But I grew up in the bottom of Alabama. I went to mostly white school, went to mostly white college. So that's very familiar territory to me. So it wasn't really intimidating. I think recognizing that I have a voice and that my voice helps somebody is something that I had to step into, and that was a little bit more of a process.
Well, let's listen to another song. I want to play another track from Room Service that sounds really different from the other one we just heard. This one's called Resolutions, and it's more like, I don't know, melodic and flowing. There's like a groove. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is Resolutions from Kadesh Flow's Room Service.
Dash. Yeah. Yeah. Stop. Wasting time checking my DMs. New year, but new me isn't what I'm seeing. Task dodger persists. Folks gassing me in my inbox, I forgot they exist. Their compliments reminding me how they thought I should quit. Popping their lips when I was cracking books and they were rapping songs they thought would be hits. Saying that none of them worked out would be too heavy-handed.
I think you understand me. They see the tour photos and crowds and think I'm falling now. They don't know my bank account is bottomed out. Was financially stable, then I quit the job. Didn't stop, but budgeting is the problem now. They don't know that every show dollar, I'm running through it. Catching up on bills and stack when I first tried to run with music. Testing patience of a couple homies, I owe money to them. On the book, people posted happy thoughts. Status all attested to a resolution. Mine is always the same, make the best improvements. Be consistent, but trying to improve my execution. Be undeniable, but don't let them detect.
Kanish, I really dig this song. Tell me, this is sounds very autobiographical.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about this entire process was MAGFest is at the beginning of the year, very beginning, January 5th, I think is when it was. So I'm thinking about the new year a lot. This song in particular, I was writing about resolutions because I really don't like them. And I feel very strongly that constant elevation, which I say at the end of the song, really should be the only goal that people have. So I'm writing about that from a lens of even thinking about how people who dissed me for rapping about anime and video games are now in my inbox, either for collab purposes or gassing me up. And just it just happened. So I was just musing over literally an in-the-moment situation.
I want to back up, though. Tell me more about people insulting you for rapping about anime.
Well, I think it's everyone I associate with has some level of story about this. I wasn't really bullied or anything. I've always was really social, and I had cousins who were either played football or kind of people nobody wanted to mess with in high school, so I didn't get messed with. But I was in. But people knew me as a good musician. I was all-state trombone player. I had a band in college that did really well around town. And when I started doing this, people were like, "What are you doing, man? Like, you do real music. This isn't real." That whole situation. And it kind of was fascinating to me that people would do that, because I'm a guy who's kind of succeeded at everything I've done, even in the midst of failure. You know, I always climb up if I fall down and knock through brick walls. And I've done all this. My resume is awesome from a college standpoint. And, you know, it's just interesting that people would doubt that the decision I was making was something I just really loved and was doing because I loved doing it.
You know, what does appeal to you? What do you love about it that maybe these other people weren't understanding?
The fact that I could be authentic about something I care about and put it in verse in a way that relates to my life. So what's interesting about, especially things with anime, role-playing video games, is if there's a lot of character development that you can superimpose yourself into. And so there are people who grew up and these games got them through things, especially people who maybe weren't as social, who really, really relate to the music I'm making. And I just really enjoyed making it. You know, I mean, not to oversimplify it, but.
And you were going to make the music about things that are authentically part of your life, anime or video games being among those.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So some stuff is just about my life, which this song is more like that. But some stuff I'm literally rapping about Final Fantasy or Skyrim or something.
But this is interesting in that, you know, you were talking earlier about the quote unquote nerd community not seeing like rap and things like that as nerdy enough. And then you're talking in some ways about the rap community not seeing video games as cool enough.
Yeah, there's a line from Drake, Drake's song from a couple albums ago, where he says, "They made fun of me because I'm black, but now I'm in rap and I'm not black enough." And that it's a similar sort of vibe. You're kind of in between. I wouldn't say a rock and a hard place, but people want to put an identity on you. Just like anything else, it's not exclusive to this community or this subgenre or anything. But people want to put an identity on you, put parameters on what you should be doing. And you're just out here being you and trying to be great and be the best you that you can be. That's kind of the situation that I find myself in. And it's not necessarily, you know, this is very celebratory. The whole project is celebratory, but I'm dealing with specific things that I think sounds a bit admonishing. So it's kind of, I guess there's a duality there.
You know, take me to the hotel room, just how this worked to record an EP in a hotel room and to do that with so many different elements. I mean, it does seem like there's some high-tech production going on.
Yeah. what happened in this situation was the first song I started writing was Resolutions. I wrote it the night before the flight to D.C.
The song we just heard.
Yes. And I hit up the people I was rooming with, so kind of a big sister for me who's in the Nerdy People of Color Collective. She was main stage in MAGFest. I was playing with her. I had some stuff. I was rooming with her and her husband and her producer, Bill Beats, who actually made that beat. And I said, hey, I'm writing. I've got a lot of ideas. Maybe we should just vibe out in the hotel room and see what happens. Atlas, another producer I worked with, was going to drive up from Atlanta. He just brought his mic. So we just kind of, we had everything there because I alerted everybody last minute that I might be ready to do something, and everybody was down to do it. So it was really beautiful. I think after that, so there are some things that I didn't do, like the progression song Resolutions part two. I didn't want to make anybody angry in a hotel room, so I waited till I got home.
I was wondering about that. I mean, who's in the hotel room next door as an album is being recorded live?
Yeah. Most of the stuff was fine, but the trombone stuff, I waited till I got back to Kansas City just to, you know, it's a kind of a loud, obnoxious instrument. And that beat is entirely trombone, with the exception of, I think, one pad and some drums.
Did you have to do anything to outfit the hotel room for this project?
No, we really didn't do anything. That's the kind of incredible part with how it sounds. And thankfully, Desmond Mason, great keys player, part of Soul Revival in Kansas City, I asked him last minute to master the project, literally right before South by Southwest. And mind you, South by Southwest was March 13th through 20th, and this came out on March 30th. So
that's amazing. Well, how is the project being received so far?
I think it's been really, really good, kind of surprising and humbling, considering the fact that I decided last minute to release it. I sent it to DistroKid while I was in Austin in the middle of a bunch of shows because I just wasn't sure what I was going to do with it. That being said, no marketing behind it. It's had a pretty good reception. People want to talk about it. People are writing about it. I'm very appreciative of that.
Well, good luck with everything, and thanks for being here.
Thank you, Gina.
Kadesh Flo is a local rapper and trombone player who just recorded an entire EP in a hotel room at a gaming conference. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Up next, the first all-Asian cast at the Unicorn Theater. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and there's a play called Viet Gone opening at the Unicorn Theater with an all-Asian cast, which it turns out is a first for the Unicorn, but also just a rarity in theater in general. Here to talk with me about that is Andy Meyer. She's part of the cast of Viet Gone, and she's also part of a local group called the Pan-Asian American Artists of Kansas City. Andy, good morning.
Good morning. Pan-Asian Artists of Kansas City is actually our old name. We rebranded to Tradewind Arts.
Tradewind Arts.
So that's us, yeah.
Very cool. Well, start out by telling me about Viet Gone, like just a synopsis of the play.
Okay. Well, Viet Gone is written by a Vietnamese-American playwright named Quy Nguyen. And if you're Vietnamese, that's not how you would pronounce his name. That's how he pronounces it in an anglicized manner and make it easy for everybody to say. But he calls himself a geek theater playwright. So it was interesting listening to your last segment. He writes for Marvel Comics as well as being a playwright. He has a theater company in New York called The Vampire Cowboys. And the play, he says, is a sex comedy about how his parents met and came from Vietnam, were evacuated to Fort Chaffee, Arkansas.
So, do you know the history of the Unicorn's decision to pursue an all-Asian cast for the play? It seems like almost just intuitive that you would have an Asian cast for a play where the characters are Asian, but this does seem to be a kind of a landmark thing.
It definitely is a landmark event. I know that it has been on the radar of the artistic director, Cynthia Levin, and the newly named associate artistic director, Ian Crawford, for several years. I've been talking with them for maybe 2 or 3 years about the script. And I know that Cynthia has really been a pioneer in Kansas City in terms of creating equity and inclusion on stage. I remember back in the 90s, she would bring people in at least once a season to be able to do an African-American play. And so I think now, 20 years later, it's finally time to have, you know, an all Asian American cast.
And you mentioned on stage. I mean, in the theater world, is there a difference between on stage equity and then like behind the scenes equity? Does that make sense? Like all the other roles right. in the theater world.
Right. Well, you know, It really does make a difference. Most of the benchmark theater organizations across the country are run by white men. You know, you'll have seasons that sometimes shake it up a little bit, and you might have some diversity that you see on stage. But, you know, a lot of times the plays will be written by white men. They'll be directed by white men, where it's interesting because the audience tickets tend to be about 70% women. So it makes a big difference, and there's all different kinds of dynamics between, you know, the producers, the board, the designers, the writers, the talent on stage, the audience, the community of arts in that city.
So in Viet Gone, it's the onstage equity that we're talking about. It's that the characters playing the actors playing Asian characters mm-hmm. are Asian.
That's right.
How many Asian actors are in this cast?
There are five of us.
And so it both is and isn't surprising to me that there is something groundbreaking about an all-Asian cast on a local mm-hmm. stage. Can you give me some context to understand the significance of that?
Well, you know, I will say that last spring, Tradewind Arts partnered with the Coterie Theater, which is one of the top five children's theaters in the country, and they do amazing work. And yet, we still don't have a lot of Asian American writers. And so the play, while there were a few of us on stage playing Asian-specific characters, we were in a play that was not written from our community. It was not somebody who was of Asian American, Asian Pacific Islander ancestry. And so that really makes a difference.
Explain how. Maybe in this case in particular, so we can really mm-hmm. look at it in maybe concrete terms.
Well, it really makes a difference who's telling your story. You know, I looked this up, and the phrase, no taxation without representation, we know very well in America from the 1700s. And it's basically the same thing. If somebody else is telling your story, if somebody else is representing you, they have a different voice, they have a different take, they have a different understanding. And so there are little in-jokes that you might get if you are a person of Asian descent. There's one of my favorite lines is one of my characters talks about the food in the Fort Chaffee refugee camp cafeteria and how it's just a plate of meat. And in America, we have a love for big pieces of meat, a big piece of chicken, a steak, a big brat on the grill. And that's not necessarily true of Asian food.
And so it required an Asian writer to be able to bring something like that to the surface.
Well, he certainly does have a different lived experience. Mm-hmm.
So tell me more about your role in this play in Viet Gone.
In Viet Gone, I play a member of the ensemble. We have two lead or principal characters who are the playwright's mother and father, and then three of us take on various different roles. So I play the playwright's grandmother, Hung. I also play a translator. I play the playwright's father's first wife. I play a flower girl. I play just an all-American, Asian-American person.
Have those of you in the cast, the five of you, had the chance to work together before?
Yes, we have. We have in various different projects. We have V-Tran, who actually produced probably what is Kansas City's first all-Asian cast with his project, The Butcher's Son, on a professional level, and he paid his actors. So yeah, there are not very many of us, and we do know each other, and we call each other up whenever we can find projects to work together in.
And you're hosting an event this weekend called Representation Matters, but with a hashtag in front of it. So yes. Hashtag representation right. matters. What is that?
That is my project as a resident of the Charlotte Street Foundation's studio residency. So we've got a big event this weekend, Open Studios, that is, it runs from 3 to 11 o'clock. My piece is going to perform at 5, between 5 and 5:30 in the dance studio at Town Pavilion. And then I have to zip off down to the Unicorn for opening night. But Representation Matters / Changing the Narrative is a piece where I've involved a lot of members of our artistic community and some activists. And there's short plays that people have written with the theme of Representation Matters and changing the narrative. So I've got one of the board members, Jose Faust of Charlotte Street Foundation, another resident, Jessica Ayala, a friend of mine, Pierre Barrera, who is a person of Native American descent, grew up on Rosebud Reservation, South Dakota, Cynthia Hardiman, Darren Kennedy, and Michelle T. Johnson are our writers, and they've put out some really stunning pieces.
What inspired you to want to take on the topic of representation in the playwriting and performing community?
The fact that there isn't enough representation. We don't have a wide enough spectrum of representation, and people get pigeonholed not only on stage, but in plays, in the arts, media representation, into these little narrow categories. And it's really my feeling that it has a culture-wide effect in the United States.
Can you give me an example of something that you have, some kind of media that you have consumed where you have found yourself doing a lot of hand-wringing and like...
Oh. anytime I see a production of Madame Butterfly is absolutely one, because that's a show that is based on a short story from the 1800s in one of those magazines, a Century magazine, that ran alongside like vampire stories and stuff. And when you read that,
so, wait, for those who aren't familiar, the story is?
Oh, the story of Madame Butterfly right. is a story of a woman in Japan who falls in love with an American soldier, and he marries her and separates her from her family, from her culture, and she's very much interested in leaving all that behind and immersing herself only in English and the American culture, and in the end, he leaves her penniless, cut off from her family, cut off from her culture. And it really just paints a very tragic and orientalized version of Asian people. And unfortunately, it's become one of the most widely known caricatures or Asian icons in Western culture, I think.
Give me an example of a trait that this character exhibits that seems very orientalizing.
Well, in the source material, she is speaking English, and it's broken English. It's written in broken English. Another character comes in and speaks to her and says, "We have to speak in Japanese because I can only understand Japanese." And so they proceed to speak in Japanese, but it's still broken English. So it just doesn't follow that somebody would be speaking their own language and still be speaking in broken English, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Well, so explain to me, like, from your perspective with both Tradewind and the event that you're doing over the weekend on representation, what do you see as the steps forward to sort of change a really long history of how that story's been told?
Well, It's going to be a long road forward. It's really going to be a long road forward. The next steps for my project is it's going to be expanded into our end of summer, end of residency, larger program. And then it's also going to be a part of the Tangled Roots program with Inner Urban Art House in August and September. I'm going to be including more writers, more pieces, and it's really an idea to start generating more representation, more accurate representation, more representation from within the communities who need to change that and to put their own voices out there and self-represent. Beyond that, it'll take job training, it'll take funding, it'll take organizational structure, strategic planning, a long road.
Job training,
because, again, you know, most of our benchmark organizations are run by white men. And, you know, the pipelines up there are pretty narrow. So all of that needs to be widened out and expanded. And for people of color to be able to get in, get the experience and figure out how things work in those roles to be able to create our own organizations and sustainable institutions.
Locally, in terms of just the Asian American acting community, can you tell me some of the stories of yourself and your fellow actors and just how you have been able to forge careers so far in a climate that so often doesn't turn to Asian Americans for those roles?
Right. It's been a very, very long road. And I think it's mostly been with dealing with writers, with material that is not from any of our communities. It's dealing with a probably mostly a white writer writing about us and putting words in our mouths that they imagine that we might say. In terms of myself, I got my degree in theater here at UMKC and just hit the job market, pounded the pavement, and have been lucky enough to find a few things here and there. Personally, I've really reached out to the National Asian American Theater Circuit. So I currently sit on the board of the Consortium of Asian American Theaters and Artists and sort of help to steer the field. We're planning a conference in Chicago in the fall. It's our sixth conference and play festival in order to find more connection and to be able to help as much as possible break ground to get our voices out there.
During that conference, what's one of the topics you'll be addressing?
We haven't set the entire schedule for that, so panels are still being decided. But adequate representation and inclusion is always an ingredient.
So Viet Gone, previews start today, and then opening night, as you mentioned, is this Saturday.
That's right.
I know you don't want to spoil anything in the play, but can you tell me about a favorite moment in the play, perhaps, that really... where you think it is really important that everyone on stage is Asian American?
An important moment that everybody on stage is Asian American. Well, I mean, I think through the entire thing, it's very important that everybody on stage is Asian American. That's the way it was written to be played by all Asian actors. And we have the opportunity to find our own reflections in the arts so people can actually come to the theater and see as close to an accurate representation of themselves as they have ever been able to in Kansas City before.
Is there a moment that's a favorite for some other reason?
There is a kung fu and ninja fight.
Kung fu and ninja?
Yes.
Wow, how does that come about?
On a cross-country motorcycle ride, the main character and his best buddy run into a biker who is not as inclusive and open-minded as many that I have been acquainted with.
So this play is... it does not come from Kansas City. It's been performed elsewhere.
Correct.
What's the reception been like? What have people said about it? And...
The reception has really been tremendous. It's been produced at least at 5 different theaters that I can think of over the last 6 months. It ran in extensions at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, which is one of the largest theater companies in the United States, and extensions in other places. It was just at Mixed Blood Theater in Minneapolis last fall. It's really been tremendous.
So what do you hope is the next kind of milestone Kansas City reaches as far as, so we have our first all-Asian cast. What do you hope is next?
Our own sustainable organization so that we can continue to put our own voices out there.
Well, Andy Meyer, good luck and thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Gina.
The previews for Viet Gone start today, but that play opens at the Unicorn Theater this weekend, and it's open through May 13th, so almost a month to catch that. And the Representation Matters event Andy talked about will be at the Charlotte Street Foundation's Open Studios next Saturday, April 21st. That's at 5 p.m. That's it for today's show. Earlier, we spoke with a hip-hop musician who recorded an album on the fly in a hotel room at a gaming convention. We also met the bilingual school secretary who is power of attorney for four families making plans for their kids in case of deportation. Those conversations will be available at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, how long does it take to make a new friend? A KU professor thinks he knows the answer. Tune in for that conversation tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. Special thanks to KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.